For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. For new people, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher at Ancient Dragon Zengate. I'm very happy to have giving a talk this morning Gyoshin Laurel Ross, who's our Eno, or head of the Meditation Hall, and also on our Practice Council. Thank you very much, Gyoshin.
Morning, everyone.
Morning.
So, there are four people here today who heard this same talk on Wednesday night at our sitting group in Rockefeller Chapel. And for them, thank you for coming. Tell me if I make any mistakes. I have a pretty straightforward topic today. I want to talk about the fourth grave precept, which is usually expressed as a disciple of Buddha does not lie. And we're going to hear more about the precept soon, because at the end of next month, in just about a month, we'll have a priest ordination ceremony, and those of us who attend that will witness a person accepting the precepts. And so the precepts come originally from Shakyamuni Buddha, but the version that we use comes from 13th century Japan, Dogen. But there have been many other sort of versions of the precepts. I want to say one thing, which is that sometimes when you're talking about the precepts, it could sound like I'm going to tell you what you should do. That is not my intention at all. What draws me to Buddhism, and particularly to Soto Zen, is this very beautiful and profound idea that through this practice that we do, we can become more compassionate beings, that that our lives can make the world a better place. And so that's the spirit in which I like to sit with the precepts. And I mentioned on Wednesday night, I sort of have this mental image of this invisible army of bodhisattvas, enlightenment beings. For brand new people, welcome, and sorry if we use words that sound strange. I'll try to define them as I go along. But awakened beings, who are sort of performing this compassionate revolution in the world and making it a better place to live. So, but how do you become more compassionate? We were just sitting Zazen, and Zazen is, in my experience, it is a way to help us open up, soften, become more open. But the precepts and the other teachings and the teachers are the other way. That's a long introduction. But a disciple of Buddha does not lie. Another version of that would be from Norman Fisher, a teacher who's been here. A disciple does not lie. Disciple of Buddha does not lie, but tells the truth. So that's sort of proactively, I'm not forbidding you to do something, but encouraging you to do something. But the version that I am just struck by is the Zen Peacemakers Order version, which Bernie Glassman leads that group, and his version is listening and speaking from the heart. It's a two-way street. It's both what we say and how we respond to what is being said from the heart. So it's right speech. Right speech is one of the tenets of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right mindfulness, right effort, right livelihood. These are the ways in the Four Noble Truths. It's the road to relief from suffering, or peace of mind, or happiness, or however you want to say that. So right speech, in a very different context. One of my favorite ecologist, Aldo Leopold, defined the word right in a way that I think works really well here. He said, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community, so of life on Earth, basically. It's wrong when it tends otherwise. So I think that's a really nice way to think about the word right, that it preserves integrity, beauty, stability. So I would say, I would look at the precepts as an encouragement to sort of look at our behavior in these regards. I'd like to figure out how we can all speak to each other in a way that promotes goodwill and compassion and healthy sangha. My New Year's resolution was to not interrupt people. It's a very bad habit. That's rude. It's the opposite of right speech, I think, or at least it's harmful to right speech. Over Thanksgiving, I spent a number of days with a large family gathering, as we often do on Thanksgiving, and many of us hadn't seen each other for quite a long time. I have the oldest of seven children, and six of us were together at Thanksgiving, and it was a difficult few days. I mean, there was a lot of fun and Scrabble playing and such, but there was also a lot of not listening to each other, just not listening and speaking from the heart. And it was frustrating. I felt like we were wasting these precious days that we have so few of together by just being self-absorbed and rude to each other. So it's interesting to try to not interrupt. I've learned a lot. I noticed that in conversations, even with some of my closest friends, we're talking about something, and sometimes we're really not listening. We're just waiting for someone to say something that we're interested in so we could talk about that thing that's our thing, rather than responding to the particular thing that the other person is saying. It's not evil. But it's really, again, it's sort of a wasted opportunity for connecting with someone. Sometimes I notice that I'm trying to say something important, and or I do say something that to me is important, and then the other person doesn't even remember it like a week later. I think they weren't probably listening, and I'm sure I'm doing the same thing, but it's disappointing. So one of my favorite things about Dharma talks is you have to listen to the whole thing and you can't respond until it's over. But then sometimes when I'm listening to a Dharma talk, I get an idea, and then I start composing my answer to, you know, what I'm going to say. And during that time when I'm, you know, thinking of my what I'm going to say, I'm really not listening to that talk, because you can't do two things at the same time. You could either be thinking about what you're doing or you could be listening. So I think that Doksan is another. So Doksan is your private meeting with your teacher, and that's another opportunity for listening and speaking from the heart. You're in a room with a closed door with someone that you have a trust relationship with, trust going both ways, and it's a precious opportunity to try to say the truth and try to hear the response. I looked for some Buddhist teachings on listening, and the best person I could find on this was Thich Nhat Hanh. He uses the term deep listening, and I'm going to read you something that he wrote, which is a chant in which he invokes Avalokiteshvara, who's the Bodhisattva of compassion. And Avalokiteshvara is usually described as hearing the cries of the world, of the suffering in the world, listening. Anyway, here is from Thich Nhat Hanh. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to help relieve the suffering in the world. You know how to listen to understand. We invoke your name in order to practice listening with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will sit and listen without any prejudice. We will sit and listen without judging or reacting. We will sit and listen in order to understand. We will sit and listen so attentively that we will be able to hear what the other person is saying and also what is being left unsaid. We know that by listening deeply, we already alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering in the other person. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. So I've been sitting with this chant recently, and it's quite powerful. I think our culture could benefit from this wisdom. Oliver Sacks, who died recently, has written many books about, he's a physician, many books about his method of his diagnostic method. He works with very, very, very difficult patients who in many cases for decades have not spoken or have been completely bizarre from our point of view. And when he was, his main diagnostic technique is listening to these people. And he has found many interesting ways to connect with them, in many cases actually help them. There's another physician, Rachel Naomi Raymond, R-E-M-E-N, who coined the term generous listening. She works with cancer patients. She says, I suspect that the most basic and powerful way to connect to another person is to listen. Just listen. Perhaps the most important thing we ever give each other is our attention, especially if it's given from the heart. She says, one of my patients told me that when she tried to tell her story, people often interrupted her to tell her that they once had something just like that happen to them. Subtly, her pain became a story about themselves. Eventually, she stopped talking to most people. It was just too lonely. I've been looking into hospice training for lay people, for non-doctors, and there are two wonderful Buddhist hospice teachers, Joan Halifax and Frank Ostaseski, both of whom have lots of information on the internet and also do workshops and various other training. And they, central to their hospice work is listening from the heart. In my own life right now, I have a close family member who's going through a terrible divorce, very unexpected, two young children. And it's not easy to listen to these two without judging or advising or accusing. But it's very clear that that would be a good thing to do, that's what's needed, that would serve them. So the other person who talks about listening that I wanted to share with you is Suzuki Roshi. I'll just read a short thing from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Beginner's Mind is really helpful for our practice, everything in our practice. Beginner's Mind is an open mind, without preconceived ideas, innocent mind. I'll tell the story that's been told many times in this room, and many of you have probably heard it, but it helps to describe beginner's mind. So philosopher visits a Zen master to learn from him, and the Zen master makes tea for their conversation. And during the time that he is making tea, the philosopher is going on and on and on and on and showing how much he knows about everything. And when the tea is done, the master pours it into the cup and pours and pours, and the cup overflows and the saucer overflows and the tea goes onto the floor, and the philosopher is telling him to stop, stop, stop. And the Zen master says, your mind is like that cup. It's already full, and how can you receive anything from me? So we need empty cups. We need to come to this with empty cups. As Taigen mentioned, I'm currently, my training job here is called Eno, and one of the things I do as Eno is help other people to learn jobs. So today Will is learning the job of doing the bells on Sunday, and people take care of the altar, and people greet, and people do, there are a lot of jobs, and they're complicated jobs. They have a lot of different parts to them, and we like them to be done in a particular way to so things run smoothly here. And one of the things that I've noticed is that new people listen really carefully to what I'm telling them, and they ask a lot of questions, and they love to get corrections on how to improve it, and they ask for that. And people that are more experienced are less so, and trust me, I am not pointing a finger except straight at myself, because there's no one in the world that dislikes taking direction as much as I do. And so it's another thing that I'm working on, is to training my cup a little bit in the effort to be better at what I want to do, which is to learn. So let me read you what Suzuki Roshi says. He has, so this book is a record of a lot of talks that he did, and he did a talk called Communication. And he says, and there's two parts, I'll read you two parts. One is about speaking, and the other is about listening. So the two-way street of communication. So about speaking, he says, in Zen, we put emphasis on demeanor or behavior. By behavior, we don't mean a particular way you ought to behave, but rather the natural expression of yourself. We emphasize straightforwardness. You should be true to your feelings and to your mind, expressing yourself without any reservations. This helps the listener to understand more easily, which is interesting. It sort of puts a share the responsibility for good listening on the speaker. So then I ask myself, how am I talking to these people when I'm, you know, am I being straightforward? You know, maybe I can be more natural. Maybe that would be helpful. Anyway, Suzuki Roshi says about listening, so when you listen to someone, you should give up all your preconceived ideas and your subjective opinions. You should just listen to him. Just observe what his way is. We put very little emphasis on right and wrong or good and bad. We just see things as they are and accept them. This is how we communicate with each other. Usually, when you listen to some statement, you hear it as a kind of echo of yourself. You are actually listening to your own opinion. If it agrees with your opinion, you may accept it. But if it does not, you'll reject it. Or maybe not even really hear it. Wow. I love that. So probably the most sickening, egregious, terrifying example of wrong listening is our current political leaders in quotes. There's really not a lot of listening going on. I have not looked at much of the debating. I sort of catch a little here and there. But they're really not listening or speaking from the heart, as far as I can tell. In fact, I've had a little bit of training in speaking to the media, and they actually tell you not to respond to the points that are made. Just keep repeating your talking points. That's the training that's given to people, and that's what you see in these debates, is just talking points going back and forth. And so, I don't know what to say about that. I have no... I suppose we could send them copies of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. We read them so much. Anyway, in our country, a lot of things are turned into commerce. So you probably, I shouldn't say just our country, in our world. So things like mindfulness. Now, you can spend a lot of money on mindfulness workshops and retreats and so forth. The same thing with listening. There's actually something called the International Listening Association, which is the ILA, and it promotes effective listening by establishing a network of professionals exchanging information, including teaching methods, training experiences and materials, pursuing research as listening affects humanity and business education and international relations. And Forbes magazine said that the most powerful leadership skill is listening. So, and here are some tips. Hold your tongue. You could pay money to get that. Anyway, so I don't know what to say about that, except I guess people are paying attention to this idea of listening, and maybe mindfulness and listening will penetrate our culture. But I'm going to end where I started, which is to say that this is an important way to pursue the way of the Bodhisattva. And, you know, what is said, what's taught to us is that Bodhisattvas turn up where there's a need, and that anyone can be a Bodhisattva, you or I, and that when we notice suffering, then we can respond to that suffering. And then we're the hands of the Bodhisattva. We've seen all these arms, and we can be those arms in the world. But I guess what I'm saying in this talk is that we can't do this unless we're listening to that. So thank you very much, and particularly thank you to the four people that heard that twice. And I'd love to listen now.
So please, anyone who has questions, comments, responses, please feel free.
Thank you, Laurel. It stirred a lot of response. I was trying to stay with you. But I'm fascinated by authors who write novels about relational stuff, and I'm reading one right now by Richard Rousseau, which is an older book, Bridges Size. But he tries to get at sometimes what happens in relationships, and he describes very well how someone's tendency to not own some of their own stuff or not be honest with themselves can bring a falseness into relationships. Mm. And it seems to me that that's a similar concept.
Yeah.
To be with someone who's wide open about what they're experiencing and then to be someone who kind of ignores or denies or some of what you're struggling with can in our relational world mean that we're not being totally open and can affect things. And so it's another dimension of that.
Kathy, you're a therapist, and I presume that an important part of therapist training is training listening skills. I'm not quite sure what the right words are. I don't know if there's anything you can share with us about that. I don't know, trade secrets. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, no, thanks for asking. It's something that as a therapist I have to keep working with, because uh-huh. I can sometimes find myself wanting to jump in and quickly give advice. And to help someone really examine their own feelings and get closer to their own feelings and more aware of what's really going on inside them, to kind of stay with that, to listen, to let them know you're listening, to mirror what you're listening, mm-hmm. is much more helpful. But it sometimes I do it better than other times, depending on how present I'm able to be, how much I'm able to kind of be still internally myself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Martin. Thank you for the talk again. It's much... I get a lot out of it. A lot of times I need to hear it over and over to really understand it. But after your talk on Wednesday, I went back and read Mind of Clover by Robert Aiken, mm-hmm. in the fourth precept. And there was a lot in there. But what I got out of it is that he said that speech is subject and object. Silence is subject and object. And in order to get rid of the separation between the two we use as them to sit and bring both subject and object together. And when you do that, what I understand is that naturally you'll just speak the truth. Hmm. Because there's no separation between subject and object.
Oh, thank you for that suggestion. I haven't heard that for a long time. I think I will look at that. Thank you.
It's good.
I love it. Conversion.
Yeah.
Silence is one response, but if anyone has some other response or question, please feel free.
David? Two things, if I may. Both in sales and child rearing. There was something I came across called active listening, where you would listen and then mirror back what the person said to confirm that you heard them properly. And that it gives a sense to the other person that you are listening and they are being heard. And it kind of disciplined me in the sense that I just can't be, which I often do, be waiting to say my thing, be waiting, which is a way how I separate myself from others. That, you know, I have to say my great thought, my great wisdom in response to what they said, you know, to try to. With the sixth precept, I guess, is one does not seek to elevate oneself at the expense of another. And that's something I have to work on, you know, because it's natural. I think in a lot of people, you know, we want to say, you know, what's what ours is and how that separates us from the other people. And active listening is maybe kind of opposite way of concentrating on what the other person is saying. It's maybe, like you said, Thich Nhat Hanh's deep listening, similar to that.
I like it that he says that listening itself, the act of listening, helps people. That I forget his exact words, but I thought about that a lot. We know that by listening deeply, we already alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering in the person. He says we know that. I think I'm just getting to learn that, or trying to learn that.
Thank you all. That last point was an interesting thing. I was just talking to my cousin this morning. She teaches third grade. She has a lot of kids on medicine for ADD. And she said what upsets her the most is, you know, parents are put their kids on this medicine and they think that's it. But she said there are all these rules about if your kid's on this medicine, you should look at the child and talk to the child and make sure the child knows you're listening. And she said it's those other things that really help the child calm down and to focus more than the actual medicine. Mm. She said she just gets so upset because she just sees these kids lining up to take this medicine and she thinks, okay, why am I doing this? And she said, if you're not doing the other part of actively listening, it's not helping. It's an interesting thing how, when you were talking about how the act of listening itself is in fact leading suffering.
Yeah, people speak so disrespectfully to children. It's really shocking sometimes.
Yes, please.
My name is Joan.
Welcome. You're the new person today.
One of the things I was thinking about is also with my children who are grown, but when they have problems, you want to repair them, you know, you want to fix it, then it took me a long time to start to realize that what I'm really trying to fix is my own anxiety. You know, I'm not really trying to fix everything for them. I'm trying to make that go away. And it actually creates more tension and conflict as I try to fix whatever their problem is, and I can't fix it. You know? So as I've learned to be quiet and just, when I say it, just shut up, it's gotten much better. And, you know, they fix their own problems, and mostly they just want to talk. So having someone better able to listen, I think, is helping have a better mom.
Thank you. Howard.
Thank you for your talk. I'm still working on my own listening, through verbal speech. But one of the most profound experiences I've ever had, actually just listening, just in general, without actually having to verbally express anything, is I spent some years playing jazz. I remember sort of thinking back about it. The first few years I started learning how to play it, I thought, oh, I need to learn how to imitate this thing. I need to learn how to express myself. Oh, you're playing that? I'm just going to play this thing that I already thought of 2 minutes ago. And it wasn't until I really sort of let myself listen to somebody else while we're all playing and actually have a very fruitful, positive conversation with each other. You're willing to express yourself while knowing and recognizing that somebody else has a very valid, important thing to say as well. And that you're also willing to accept any mistakes that may come up. And you're kind of willing to laugh at it, not laugh at them, but willing to laugh together at whatever mistakes might happen and integrate them into the conversation as well. That's some of the best active listening I've ever experienced in my life. And I kind of have an inkling of an understanding of what a real conversation can be like. Mm-hmm. And I have to learn how to integrate that back into, oh, okay, now I'm actually using words. I'm more easily disagree on these things. Okay, this is a little more difficult, but at least I have a nice inkling of that.
I love that example. That's so great. I've never been enough of a musician to play jazz, but I sing in choirs, and you cannot sing in a choir without listening to everything else, because your job is, you have to become one in a choir, just like in Zen. And so you have to listen to all the other parts and be sure it becomes one voice, and listening is a huge part of it. But I hadn't thought of that. Thank you. Pianos are the worst.
We're all in the singer.
Any last comments or questions or responses, please feel free.
That made me think of the other thing about active listening. It's part of it is allowing yourself to be influenced. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like being malleable.
Yeah, that's important. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, we probably mostly enter conversations not expecting to be influenced. That's really great. I love that.